Hey everybody, this is your best friend Steven.
And this is your best friend Chris.
And we're the hosts of the podcast, Is This Adulting?
Every week, we sit down to talk about life, debate pointless topics, and most importantly, break the stigma on mental illness through opening up about our own struggles and how it affects us every day. Oh, and do you like games? We got those too.
What about guests from all your favorite podcasts?
Ooh, like Justin from Generation Y, or Nina from Already Gone, or Hal Lublin from Everything? And of course, you can't forget our special guest, Tom Baudet, from those Motel 6 commercials. Okay, that last one might have been a stretch.
Yeah, just like them. So, join us each Thursday as we attempt to navigate adulthood as overgrown man children. And remember, kids, be happy, stay healthy, and go hug someone.
Because you never know, they might just be the host of your new favorite podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Insight. I'm Ali and we are back with our third guest spot for the sixth guest rotation while Charlie is on maternity leave. So far we have had Christy from Canadian True Crime and Zach from Mystery Guest Podcasts. But this episode we have an almost neighbour of mine from across the dotch. It's Jess from Kiwi Crimes Podcast. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
How was my Kiwi accent?
Average.
So your podcast is the fabulous Kiwi Crimes Podcast. I've been right behind you since, I think, before you released your first episode. Little known fact, I helped Jess come up with the name of the podcast, and you're welcome. Did you want to tell the listeners about your podcast and where they can find you?
Yes, I would. Yes, you have been with me since the very beginning. In fact, I think I messaged you and said I think I'm going to start a podcast, and you were right behind me right from the beginning. So I host Kiwi Crimes, which is a podcast that focuses on missing person and murder cases from New Zealand. You can find me on Twitter at Kiwi Crimes Pod, or on Facebook you can find me at Kiwi Crimes Podcast, or on our discussion group, Kiwi Crimes Podcast discussion group.
Before we start today's episode, a small announcement. Charlie and I are now working with the Orbital Jigsaw Network. It's a new network with some of your favourite podcasts involved. Besides Insight and Insight Junior, of course, you'll find The Dirty Bits, California Dreaming, The Concessional Stand, Super Nerds UK, and Is This Adulting, whose promo you will hear at the top of the episode. And the host of Is This Adulting, Stephen, he will be a guest right on this show next week, which I'm really looking forward to. Head on over to orbitaljigsaw.com to check out all of these podcasts and some others. You can buy some awesome merch there as well to show your support. Today we're talking about the case of Sally Ann Huckstep. And like with Matrice a few weeks back and Talika Patrick last week, we're trying to cover more cases lately of people who tend to get lost in the system. The people who go missing, who are murdered, who die in suspicious circumstances, but potentially you haven't heard of them, or if you have, it's because you live in the area or it caught your eye for whatever reason. But these cases don't get the attention they deserve, and they don't get the investigation they deserve. Sally Ann Huckstep was a 31-year-old police whistleblower who opened up Australia's eyes to the world of police corruption. And then in 1986, Sally Ann's body was found in a Sydney park. She was strangled and drowned. Her killer has never been found. Sally Ann Christochow was born December 12, 1954, into a middle-class Jewish family. She grew up in the Sydney's eastern suburbs, along with her younger sister Deborah, and she attended the exclusive Dover Heights High School. But things weren't great at home. Her parents were divorced, and she lived with her father Jack and her new stepmother, who she didn't get along with. As a result, her behaviour began to somewhat spiral out of control.
When Sally Ann was 14, she went to court for smoking Indian hemp, and she was released on a 12-month probation. But, at her father's request, she was sent to the Minda Remand Centre at Lidcombe in the western suburbs of Sydney. Minda is known as a home for rebellious and out-of-control children. It was here that she met Brian Huckstep, who was somewhat of an artist. After she was released from there, she left school at 17 and found a job as a waitress at a King's Cross club called Whiskey A Go-Go. She married her boyfriend Brian, who was a heroin addict at this point. They moved to Calgary together, and because heroin isn't the cheapest addiction, she started working as a sex worker on the streets. They both later moved back to Sydney, where she too started using heroin, which she quickly became addicted to. They moved to the King's Cross area, which is infamous for the criminal underground. Together, Sally Ann and Brian had a daughter, Sasha, in 1973. Sally Ann and Brian's relationship soon falls apart. They divorce, but they remain friends. Under the circumstances, she is a good mother. She loves her daughter, she is the most important person in her life, and she does everything she can to provide for her. It was through her associations in Sydney's underworld that Sally Ann became highly aware that the New South Wales Police were heavily involved in criminal activities, and that Roger Rogerson was one of the kingpins.
In 1980, Rogerson was moved to the Darlinghurst Police Station. He was considered the star detective in the armed hold-up squad. During this era in Sydney, the heroin market was in high demand, in particular in the King's Cross area, and the opportunity to make some extra cash was hard to resist. We are still many years away from the true nature of Rogerson's corrupt activities as we are aware now to be released to the wider public, but we'll talk more about that later. One of the top heroin distributors in the city was a man named Neddy Smith, and he was making some major money. And because of his power in the underworld, he and Rogerson, they formed a kind of mutually beneficial association. Smith would later turn police whistleblower in the early 1990s. This is when he testified at the Independent Commission Against Corruption. He claimed that the armed hold-up squad detectives had been supplying information that enabled him to carry out a string of hold-ups. However, due to their relationship, Smith refused to name Rogerson during that hearing. In 1981, Sally Ann started a relationship with a heroin dealer, Warren Lanfranchi, and his further connection to the story was that he was also a standover man for Neddy Smith.
In June of 1981, Lanfranchi had just been released from jail after serving all but 4 months of a 5-year sentence for stealing colour TV sets. It's during this time he becomes friendly with Neddy Smith and starts working for him. He looked up to him as a role model of sorts, and he wanted to be someone like him, with the power he could use in the criminal underworld. Both bonded over their love of boxing. Both were very good boxers. And then he saw the money Neddy was making and wanted to be a part of that. And there were rumours going around that he was assaulting people with a baseball bat. Warren Lanfranchi fired shots at a young policeman. To avoid facing charges, he asked Neddy Smith, who was an associate of his. They worked together from time to time. He asked Smith to negotiate a price with Rogerson. At the time, Rogerson still had an impeccable reputation within the police force. So much so, he was slated to potentially become the next police commissioner.
Before we continue, a word about one of our sponsors this week, BarkBox.
Picks the best all-natural treats and toys to match your dog's needs, including if they have allergies or if they're heavy chewers or based on their size. All edibles are made in the USA or Canada, so you can trust these products when you give them to your dog. Probably the thing I liked the most about it, other than that it made Lacey happy and kept her occupied with these really great toys, is that the variety of treats and toys are from local small businesses. I was able to try them with Lacey, and now I know these products are out there. I wouldn't have known about them otherwise, and now I can go get them and order them for her if they're ones that she really likes. But each month you get a new themed box with these toys and these treats, and if your dog doesn't like something in the box, they'll send you a replacement item for free, because that's what this is about. This is about making your dog happy. Fortunately, I didn't have to take him up on this. Lacey loved everything in the box. You can get a free extra month of BarkBox when you subscribe to a 6 or 12 month plan by going to BarkBox.com/insight. So visit BarkBox.com/insight for that free extra month.
It's Saturday, June 27, 1981, and the news headlining the afternoon newspapers. You might remember from our Grey and Thorn episode, there were two editions of newspapers in early 1980s Australia. There was a morning edition, which would cover any major news from the day or night before, And then there was an afternoon edition, and that would be updates of those news stories as well as anything of significance that happened during the day. And what happened on this Saturday was big. The afternoon newspapers were headlining talking about the shooting of Len Franchi by Rogerson. You see, what happened was Rogerson had placed a hit on Len Franchi. He arranged for Smith to drop Len Franchi at Danger Place in Chippendale, where he was waiting to ambush him with 18 other police officers. It was here Rogerson shot Len Franchi twice. He later claimed that this was in self-defence. Len Franchi would be the third man Rogerson had shot dead in a public place in a 5-year period, so this would prove not an unusual situation Rogerson would find himself in. Len Franchi's girlfriend, Sally Ann, she believed there was more to this story than what was being reported in the media and that he was murdered. 2 weeks later, Sally Ann turned up at police headquarters with her father and a detailed string of allegations against the whole of New South Wales police, in particular against Roger Rogerson. These claims included that Rogerson had executed her boyfriend Len Franchi and stolen the $10,000 he had with him that he was going to bribe Rogerson with.
But of course, the police didn't want to hear about it. He was a former sex worker and known heroin dealer and user, making serious and damaging claims against one of their more respected officers. So, when they didn't listen to her, she decides to make what she knows public in the most public way possible. She goes to the newspapers and she is interviewed by 60 Minutes. She is well-spoken and admits that even though she was in love with Len Franchi, she knows he wasn't the nicest of guys. That he was a criminal and a thug and did things wrong. He did break the law. But then, so did the people who were responsible for his death. And if you watch the interview with her, she is quite believable. It does very much seem like she is telling the truth. Sally Ann says that Len Franchi unknowingly ripped off drug dealers who were working for corrupt police. And, with the help of Nettie Smith, arranges a payoff that involves giving $10,000 to Roger Rogerson immediately, and then another $20,000 at a later date. And it's in a back lane in the inner city suburb of Sydney called Chippendale that this meeting was to take place. The inquest included so many theories and allegations, and the final determination was quite significant. It was determined that while, yes, Rogerson shot Len Franchi, and he may not have acted in self-defence, he had not done anything untoward. In fact, Rogerson was commended for his bravery. The media celebrated it as a win of good, a police officer, over evil, a drug dealer. And because of this, Rogerson was never charged with Len Franchi's murder. His only convictions were of preventing the course of justice and lying to the Police Integrity Commission in 2005.
And this is where it all starts for Sally Ann. A lot of people say that she is a whistleblower and she is an anti-hero of types. But really, when you look through all the media reports, and there is a book based on her called Huckstep, A Dangerous Life by John Dale, it seems that she had a vendetta against Rogerson, and what she really wanted was to get her revenge on him for killing her boyfriend. And everything that is to come, it seems like it was out of her loyalty to Len Franchi and to just get back at Rogerson. So shortly after her interview on 60 Minutes that you were talking about, Jess, it was reported on the National Times newspaper that a large sum of money was being offered in the underworld to have Sally Ann killed. And it wasn't just Len Franchi's shooting that led to this. That was just a part of it. Because she then gave evidence to the Internal Affairs about the police corruption that she was aware of that was going on. Over a period of 5 to 10 years, she paid off a number of police officers in the drug squad to turn a blind eye to her dealings. So once she went public with what she knew, her life changed. She had a major target on her head, and yes, she did have concerns for her own safety, but at the time she was enjoying her newfound fame. She was writing for Penthouse, she was getting offers to write an autobiography, and she was mixing with the creative types in Sydney, like artists and TV celebrities and rock stars, which is all well and good, but it didn't last long.
Soon after this, Sally Ann starts another relationship with a man named David Keller. Keller has numerous convictions for importing illegal drugs. He was known as this tough guy, a bit of a thug. He was a major player in the drug scene. He was from the same kind of background as Sally Ann. He was from a middle-class family. Sally Ann was known to call Keller her blonde god. They had a long relationship before he went to jail for a long period of time. He was convicted for importing heroin worth more than $2 million. and she was left, small-time dealer, broke with a small child.
And during this time too, she was also back using heroin again.
That's when she became involved with the federal police to try and get Keller out of jail. Sally Ann attempts to get a brief of Keller's upcoming trial through the federal police, and, in return, she assists them with their search for some stolen furs. But things are further complicated when Sally Ann starts an affair with Constable Peter Parker Smith. And Smith is one of the AFP, the Australian Federal Police officers in question. And all of this didn't show any trust. She was back taking drugs, she was involved with criminals, and now she is involved with a police officer who she could be telling anything to. One, about her involvement with the AFP. And I guess, to protect her back somewhat, she started recording all of her conversations and dealing with both the AFP and the state police she was working with. She attempted to sell these conversations to the media, but they weren't interested in illegally obtained recordings.
Sally Ann continued her relationship with Keller during this period. She would visit him regularly in jail, and she would admit to him that she was having an affair with Smith. But in her version to him, it was in an attempt to get information from Smith which could be useful in Keller's trial. Now, Nettie Smith would later back up this story and claim that Sally Ann was trying to help Keller by making these tape recordings of her conversations with Constable Smith for that exact purpose. But before we discuss the tragic events of February of 1986, a word about our second sponsor this week, Brooklinen. You're going to spend a third of your life wrapped up in your sheets. So are they taking care of you the way they should be? At brooklinen.com, you get high-quality sheets and bedding that you deserve at an accessible price. Brooklinen was founded in April 2014 by a husband and wife team. They have a simple philosophy, and that is we deserve simple, beautiful home essentials, but without the luxury price. Most high-end bedding is marked up by 300% by the time it reaches the store. Brooklinen cuts out unnecessary markups and manufacturing waste in order to offer exquisite designs and exceptional savings across their whole collection. This is luxury bedding underpriced. You have to try these sheets today. My Brooklinen sheets are definitely the best sheets I've ever slept in. I love mine, and I know that you'll love them too. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for Insight listeners. Get $20 off with free shipping when you use promo code SITE at brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you will love your new sheets, they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. There is no reason not to give these sheets a try. The only way to get $20 off with free shipping is to use promo code SITE at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code SITE. Brooklinen. These are the best sheets ever. On Thursday, February 7, 1986, at 4 p.m, 31-year-old Sally Ann arrived home and she sat by her window of her two-bedroom apartment, which was directly over a heater shop in the inner eastern Sydney suburb of Edgecliff. She had a fracture to her forearm that was causing her some pain, and sometimes just sitting there staring out into nothing, it helped with that. She was wearing an apricot lacy camisole with matching shorts. She was last seen by her roommate, Gwendolyn Beecroft, at about 11 p.m. that night. Sally Ann was in the shower and Gwendolyn was in bed when the phone rang. It woke her up and she went to answer it. A man's voice said,
"Is Sally Ann there? It's Wazza. At least I haven't got to go to Ashfield this time."
After this call, Sally Ann was flustered. The only thing she would tell her flatmate is that at least she didn't have to go to Ashfield this time. Ashfield was normally where she would go to pick up her drugs. Before she leaves, she starts pacing and acting erratically. She got changed into a blue top and jeans. She leaves the apartment, but right away she comes racing back up the stairs. Gwendolyn later reports that Sally Ann was very frantic and looking for her keys. She tosses over several cushions, saying that everything is fine and she will return in 5 to 10 minutes. And then she leaves again. Gwendolyn waits by the front window, waiting for a car to leave, but there was nothing. At the end of the day, due to Sally Ann's associates and the circle she mixed in, it wasn't unusual for Sally Ann to go out at this time, and Gwendolyn trusted Sally Ann wouldn't put herself in an unnecessarily dangerous situation. But it seems she did get into her car, and she drives to Centennial Park. Centennial Park is about a 5 to 10 minute drive from where Sally Ann was living, particularly at that time of night when there was no traffic and no one around. Now, this wasn't the first time Sally Ann had gotten phone calls from Wazza. A man by the name of Warren Richards, or Wazza as Sally Ann called him. At this point, because of her involvement with the police, Richards was the only person still willing to deal drugs to Sally Ann. And Richards wasn't what you would call your friendly neighbourhood drug dealer. He had numerous convictions for importing and dealing illegal drugs. Like her deceased boyfriend, Lanfranchi, Richards was also an acquaintance of Nettie Smith and soon-to-be disgraced detective Roger Rogerson. In the 1980s, it seemed that corruption was more widespread than it had been in the past, because the drug trade was the biggest it had ever been, and arguably ever will be, to this day.
Richards would call Sally Ann every second day. At first, she seemed happy to get the calls. She told Gwendolyn that Richards fancied her, but she wasn't interested in him. She would never go into any more information as to why she didn't want anything from his advances, though. However, over the 2 or 3 weeks before the last phone call, the tone of the phone calls changed. She owed Richards money, and not just a little money, but a lot of money. She told Gwendolyn that she was trying to pay it off through dealing heroin. 2 days before this particular day, Sally Ann went and visited Richards, and she seemed really scared. It was almost as if he was harassing her about the money and who knows what else. But she owed him $600 and she was short. She asked Gwendolyn for a loan of $100, but she didn't have enough. Apparently he would boast to her how he had killed people and how he sold babies just to scare her. When Sally Ann arrives at Centennial Park, she parks on Martin Road, which is adjacent to Centennial Park, and she enters the park, which didn't have a lot of lighting. She's never seen alive again. The following morning, a jogger reports to the ranger that he saw a body floating in Busby's Pond, which is in Centennial Park. Police are on the scene immediately, and they realise that this is the body of Sally Ann Huckstep. Despite a thorough search of the pond, there are no clues for police as to what happened to her. By all reports, it seemed as if Sally Ann had been drowned, but the initial post-mortem states that the cause of death was inconclusive. A second post-mortem is immediately requested, and this is returned as there being evidence on Sally Ann to suggest manual strangulation. And what manual strangulation is when someone is strangled using hands, fingers, or sometimes blunt objects such as holding something like a bat hard against the throat. Anything like that that would stop someone from breathing and stop the blood flow to the neck. Almost 2 weeks after the murder, the official cause of death is given as drowning due to asphyxia.
The basic line of the investigation was trying to retrace her steps that night. There was a search of the crime scene and a lot of false leads came from that. Like, for example, a police badge was found in the park, which got widespread media attention. And what happened in the end, the badge had a serial number on it, and that number belonged to an inner-city forensic scientist that responded to the scene after the body was found, and was then given the job of helping to search the grounds, and his badge simply fell off in the grass. So that was one thing that happened. Then, the police officers went back to the apartment to search there and interview people who were there because that's where Sally Ann got the phone call. But the problem there was other police officers had already done this and contaminated the crime scene. And this was at no knowledge or approval of the investigating officers. These officers were ones with a somewhat vested interest in the case. Because of this, progress in the case was slow, fragmented, and vital information was not passed on to the appropriate investigating officers. There was a list of suspects that the police wanted to look into. People like her former partner, David Keller. Even though he and Sally Ann still talked and seemed friendly, he didn't trust her with the information that she knew about him. The police wondered if he thought she was about to blow the whistle on him, or if she was trying to set him up, and that could be a possible motive for him to kill her.
So who could have killed her? We have Nettie Smith and Roger Rogerson.
Rogerson had moved into a different circumstance from being a police officer to being an associate of criminals. And I can imagine he didn't want anyone to know about this in his job and in the wider community. Sally Ann didn't like Nettie Smith. She tolerated him at best. But they were associates through drugs. And then you have Warren Richards. We know he definitely made the phone call. That was the reason she went out at that time of night. The two main suspects to police were Smith and Rogerson. Neither had a strong alibi. Actually, Rogerson didn't have an alibi at all. He claims he was at the Marylands Bowling Club with some other people, but he didn't want to name names. So I don't think that could be considered a solid alibi. It's just something that he claims happened. But he has no proof of that. There is no record of him signing in that night. I mean, I could say to our listeners that I'm wearing Ninja Turtle socks. You can't see that. It's just my word, but how trustworthy is that really? For the record, it's not true, although I kind of wish it was. Prior to the inquest, Nettie Smith was interviewed by four separate teams of detectives. He claims he was at his home in Newcastle with his wife celebrating their wedding anniversary on the night of Sally Ann's death. And as any lawyer worth their salary will tell you, there's a big difference between information and evidence. Everyone seemed to have information to tell the police, but no one had the hard facts and evidence to back up what they were saying.
The inquest into Sally Ann Huckstep's death begins in Office of the State Coroner's Court on January 20th, 1987. Over the next 4 years until 1991, there will be just 19 sitting days. Warren Richards still refuses to answer any questions on the grounds that it might incriminate him. And because this is an inquest and not a proper hearing, he doesn't have to testify in court. And David Keller? He also says nothing. Keller was reminded by the coroner that as he was called up, he was obliged to answer certain questions under the Coroner's Act. He wasn't fazed by this because he was already serving a 25-year sentence. Roger Rogerson straight out admitted that he would rather not have Sally Ann around, but he would never resort to killing her for the pleasure. Nettie Smith was never questioned or called up to give evidence. And that's despite the fact he was seen in the company of Warren Richards in the Covent Garden Hotel a little more than a month after Sally Ann's murder. During the inquest, Constable Smith testified that she had told him she was frightened that Nettie Smith with Roger Richardson or David Keller would murder her. But in Keller's defence, he was in jail at the time of her death. The inquest finishes the same way it started. The ruling was that there was insufficient evidence to charge anyone with Sally Ann Huckstep's murder. And a major break in the case is still a number of years away.
So let's fast forward to the mid-1990s, and the investigation into Sally Ann's murder has gone cold. But one of the main suspects, Nettie Smith, who by this stage is suffering from Parkinson's disease, he's in jail for his part in the murder of a tow truck driver. Now, a prisoner who has never been named due to safety reasons, mainly because ratting out someone in jail, especially a big name like Nettie Smith, that would never make you Mr. Popularity with the other prisoners. But this particular prisoner is sharing a cell with Nettie Smith in Long Bay Jail, and he used to record music off the radio. But on this one occasion, he taped Smith talking about the murders he had committed, and he played it to himself the next morning. He, of course, thinks to himself, look, how can I use this to my advantage? So he contacts the prison authorities. They in turn contact the police and they install a tape recorder in his computer. And he starts recording Nettie Smith every night. Smith said he killed Sally Ann because Roger Rogerson told him that she was recording police who were supplying heroin to the drug trade. Apparently there was a group of police officers that were stealing drug evidence and selling that to known drug dealers in the area. Now, according to the tapes, Smith is lying in the grass beside the gates in Centennial Park when Sally Ann arrives to meet Warren Richards. In Richards' presence and without his prior knowledge, allegedly, Smith ambushes Sally Ann and attacks her. He hits her a number of times before snapping her jugular. Sally Ann, being the fighter she was, she doesn't give up and she scratches Smith down both sides of his face. Smith then strangles Sally Ann for 6 minutes. He lifts her feet off the ground in the process. Now she loses consciousness, but she's still alive. Smith applies a ligature made out of a piece of cord and two wooden broom handles around her throat. But when that fails, he decides to drown her. He claims in the tapes that with the help of Warren Richards, Sally Ann is dragged into Busby Pond. Smith then stands on her back in the shallow water for a further 5 minutes. By that stage, Sally Ann Huckstep would have most certainly drowned.
But Smith's story contains some irregularities from the actual facts as we know them. He says he leaves a federal police badge that Roger Rogerson had given him next to the body. And we know that's not true. But a lot of the details he does describe about how he was hiding in the grass when Richards brought her in, how he jumped up and grabbed her by the throat and started punching her and strangling her and stepping on her in the water in the pond to keep her under. He is a big man and she was a very petite woman, and he kept saying on the tapes how hard it is to strangle someone with your bare hands. Those type of details make you think it is possible that he does know something more, and that he could have very possibly been involved or had some insider knowledge of what happened to her. But the addition in his story of the federal police badge is an interesting addition, given that no such badge was ever discovered in the investigation and the search of the park or the Busby Pond area. I mean, it is possible that he added that part to the story to try and implicate Rogerson in the murder. I don't know. But historically, you can say that basically any confession overheard or discussed in jail between prisoners, there is always a small detail that they don't tell you. For some reason, there can be complete confessions given, but you always find that some little detail doesn't match up.
There's also a chance that there was parts of the investigation that wasn't released to the public, or maybe Rogerson's badge was there and one of his friends or associates picked it up before the investigating police could find it. In a subsequent statement, Nettie Smith says that the tape confession of 6 murders, including that of Sally Ann Huckstep, it was all a fabrication. Something that he came up with because he knew that his cellmate was an informant and that he knew he was being recorded. But what's most convincing about the story in the tapes, at least in my opinion, is that Smith seems to be relishing in the story of how he killed her and how much he hated her, and that he enjoyed it. That with the other murders, it was a job, but this one was personal, and he got enjoyment out of killing her. And he says on the tapes it was the best thing he had ever done in his whole life. Interestingly, Smith was later interviewed by the author of the book I was talking about earlier, John Dale. In this interview, he claimed that Sally Ann was murdered because she kept bugging Roger, ringing him up and leaving him messages that he was a dog. The reason they didn't bury her or dispose of the body was Roger wanting her left floating in the pond as a message. Meanwhile, Sally Ann's body is exhumed and re-examined. An x-ray shows a fracture. There's a small bone in the back of your throat called a hyoid bone, and that bone has been sort of crushed or fractured in Sally Ann's case. It had been displaced, which is common in strangulation. And this fracture didn't show up in the original radiographs in 1986, but thankfully it seems that technology had caught up for Sally Ann. Given the details of Smith's confession, this is a significant finding. Sally Ann's fingernail clippings are sent to England for DNA analysis, which is a telling piece of evidence because Smith says in the tapes how she scratched him down both sides of the face. And to cover this up, he got Michelle Richards to do the same thing to him in the pub. Now, Michelle Richards is not only Warren Richards' wife, but she is also Nettie Smith's former girlfriend. We may need a flowchart soon to keep track of all this.
I need a flowchart. Smith is now charged with Sally Ann Huckstep's murder. At the committal hearing, a witness, codenamed Mr. Green, claims that in February of 1986, Smith called him and said, quote unquote, "I'm going to get rid of Sally. I want you to bury her for me." It's established through DNA testing that the cellular material under Sally Ann's fingernails could have come from Nettie Smith. And we know the taped confession is chilling. After the committal hearing, it looks obvious that Smith had killed her. There was overwhelming evidence leading towards Smith being guilty. Magistrate Pat O'Shane orders Nettie Smith to stand trial in the Supreme Court for Sally Ann Huckstep's murder. But the Crown's case falters. The prosecution is hindered by changed testimony, inconsistencies, and most importantly, the absence of vital witnesses such as Bill Duff. Bill Duff was the owner of the Iron Duke Hotel. He maintains that Neddy Smith came in there with scratches down his face the morning after the murder. He wasn't called to give evidence, and his evidence would probably be the most incriminating, and he wasn't called because apparently there's a policy against using witnesses that had previously been incarcerated.
Which is ridiculous because in this case it could have made all the difference in the world for the result in the trial.
It could have been absolutely pivotal.
Exactly.
It's just silly.
I don't see how him being incarcerated before is even relevant to this case, unless he was somehow involved in the suspects. But then again, I don't see how it's relevant.
I agree. I don't think it's relevant at all. I think it's a law that might be a bit outdated.
Exactly.
A jury of 8 men and 4 women find Neddy Smith not guilty for killing Sally Ann Huckstep. And he is sent back to prison where he is already serving a life sentence for the murder of tow truck driver Ronnie Flavel in 1988.
In September of 1998, Neddy Smith is also convicted of the murder of brothel owner Harvey Jones, which is quite interesting because despite being charged with 8 murders, Smith has only ever been convicted with those 2. In recent times, when a profile is established for major crime figures, the first thing often that you'll find is that they've been charged with murders but acquitted. That through drugs and other illegal activities, look, they have the means, they have the money, the connections to hire the best of the best of solicitors, and then they're able to find any discrepancy or loophole in the police investigation. So Jess, what do you think happened here? I mean, do you think anyone we talked about here today could be involved, or maybe someone else entirely?
So I think it was probably Neddy Smith, but I think that Roger Rogerson was involved somehow. I don't know if he was there, but I don't know. I just get this feeling like he was involved somehow, but I just can't sort of explain how to tie him in.
I think it's unlikely that Neddy Smith acted on his own in this type of crime. Maybe because the other murders he was convicted of, they seem very different in that those murders were a result of a fight between 2 men. And especially in a case like Sally Ann's murder, that would bring so much media scrutiny to both him and Roger Rogerson in particular. And the way Neddy Smith says on the tapes that, well, this has to be done, it's like he was acting under orders from someone. Was that Roger Rogerson or someone else? Look, that I don't know.
I agree that I really don't think that Neddy Smith was acting alone, and I completely agree that it was an out-of-character murder for him. And that's why I kind of wonder if Roger Rogerson was involved somehow, and then that makes the connection back to him saying the badge was there. I mean, there's just a lot of factors at play in this case.
And the fact that someone like Rogerson was involved could explain why Neddy Smith then backpedaled and said that the confession was made up because of some kind of deal he had with him or another police officer.
It's entirely possible because Roger Rogerson would have a lot of connections.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think the inquest sums up this case quite well. The coroner concluded that even though Sally Ann was willingly involved in the drug trade, both as a dealer and with her heroin addiction, and she was acquaintances with some shifty characters, but that didn't mean that her death was her own fault, and that didn't mean that she deserved it. But she would have had to have known the risks she was taking. She knew a lot of what was going on with the corruption within the police and who was connected with who in the criminal underworld. Sally Ann will go down as one of the most important, if not the most important, whistleblower in New South Wales police history. She'll go down as someone who was loyal to what she believed in and did what she thought was right. Between 1994 and 1997, a decade after Sally Ann was murdered, the Woodrall Commission revealed the level of police corruption that Sally Ann was trying to expose at the time of her death. And in her own small way, she helped to eradicate. For his role in the police corruption, Roger Rogerson was sentenced to a 2.5-year sentence, of which he served 12 months. He was released on February 17, 2006. On May 27, 2014, Rogerson was charged with the murder of Jamie Gow. On May 19 of 2014, 20-year-old Sydney student Jamie Gow arrives at the Meridian Hotel in Hurstville in Sydney South to make the final arrangements for a drug deal with former police detective turned true crime writer and police investigator Glenn McNamara. They walk to a quiet area of the pub near the pool tables, They have a conversation, they shake hands, and they leave at 8:23 p.m. according to the CCTV footage. It was the last of 27 meetings between the pair in 2014. Within 18 hours after this, Jamie will be dead.
Dressed in a hoodie, cap and sunglasses, McNamara drives Jamie into a deserted industrial estate in Padstow in Sydney's southwest. He punches in the entry code at the front gate of a renter space. It is 1:42 p.m. At 1:46 p.m, McNamara pulls up outside storage shed 803, carefully parking so the back door of the car aligns with the storage shed roller door. He opens the car's back door and sneaks Jamie into the shed. 3 minutes later, a man with a distinctive gait ambles over to the unit, making no attempt to conceal his identity. This man is Roger Rogerson. At 1:58 p.m, Rogerson moves his car in front of McNamara's. McNamara emerges 5 minutes later, collects a surfboard bag from his car, and takes it into the shed. McNamara drags the surfboard bag, now containing Jamie's body, out of the storage shed at 2:18 p.m. Rogerson helps him lift it into the boot of the car. The two men drive away. 2 hours after leaving the storage unit with Jamie's body, Rogerson and McNamara enter Kennard's Hire in Tarrant Point. They hire a block and tackle to help them lift a heavy load. Another 2 hours later, cameras in the lift at McNamara's Cronulla apartment complex capture him and Rogerson with a six-pack of beer. They have already moved Jamie's body into McNamara's boat and the garage downstairs. The following day, at 7:28 a.m, McNamara tows the boat out of his apartment complex and they leave the Cronulla apartment with two fishing rods. Their trial heard that they then dumped Jamie's body at sea.
Roger Rogerson and his co-accused, Glenn McNamara, they arranged not only for the murder, but also for supplying 6 pounds, or almost 3 kilograms, of methamphetamine. The men were due to go to trial in Supreme Court on July 20, 2015. On the second day, the trial was aborted because of the potential prejudice caused by then McNamara's solicitor, a man named Charles Waterstreet. He made a reference to Rogerson possibly killing one of two people when he was a police officer. A new trial started on February 1st, 2016, and then a little over 4 months later, on July 15th, both Rogerson and McNamara are found guilty for Jamie Gow's murder. The New South Wales Crown Prosecutor argued that both men should get a life sentence because it seemed obvious that there was a distinction between Jamie's murder being a contract killing and a murder for the only purpose of financial gain. And that's a dangerous combination. And it worked. On September 2nd of 2016, both Rogerson and McNamara were sentenced to life in prison. There was indication at the time that there would be an appeal. Now that process does take time, and we will keep you all updated if and when that appeal goes ahead in the future. Rogerson is now in his mid-70s.
Despite the fact that he will be in prison for the rest of his life, Smith continues to refuse to assist police with ongoing investigations of unsolved murders, which were not covered by the immunity granted to him in exchange for his testimony against allegedly corrupt police officers at the Independent Commission Against Corruption and the Wood Royal Commission hearings. In April of 2017, Smith attempted to escape custody while being treated for heart problems at the Prince Wales Hospital in Randwick. Smith is now in his mid-70s. In April of 2012, Warren Richards, who was the drug dealer allegedly present when Sally Ann was murdered, he was charged and convicted with supplying almost 4 pounds or 1.5 kilograms of methamphetamines and for receiving stolen goods. He is currently serving a sentence for those crimes. And, interesting side fact, he competed in judo for Australia in the 1976 Montreal Olympics. Richard is now in his mid-60s.
Now, I couldn't find whether David Keller was still alive. He was serving a life sentence at the time that Sally Ann was killed, and I assume since I couldn't find any articles on him that he is still in jail or he has since died. So if anyone out there does know where David Keller is at the moment, please let us know on Facebook. Now, Sally Ann's only child, Sasha, she's an actress and a successful casting agent in Sydney. Sasha had a minor role as a nurse in the Australian miniseries Blue Murder, which featured a character based on her mother. She also appeared in a British soap opera called Families,
and she continues to fight for justice for her mother along with Sally Ann's sister Deborah. There are articles with interviews with both of them where they say that they will not give up until the murderer of Sally Ann is brought to justice. Unfortunately, with the chief suspects here already serving life sentences and they're not getting any younger, I can't see them confessing to the murder at this stage. Unfortunately for Sasha, Deborah, the rest of Sally Ann's family and those who believe in what Sally Ann was doing, I can't see this murder being solved.
So in Australia, I just ask, you don't even have to put this is just my general interest. In Australia, is a life sentence a life sentence? Like here it's like life with parole after like 10 years?
Life sentence is 25 years with the possibility of parole after a third of the sentence being served, which would be about 10 years.
Okay, but these guys aren't likely to be getting parole, so there's...
I can't see with the history of all these suspects, I can't see any of them getting parole.
No, I can't either.
And at their age, I can't see them getting out of prison.
No, so there's really no, there'd be no reason for them to roll over on the other one unless the possibility of parole was maybe brought up.
Or if one of them grows a conscience, which I doubt.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Not at this stage.
No.
Which is sad because what she was doing was, it changed everything for the police and the way people viewed police, and it pretty much helped stop corruption at that level because of what she did, because of what she believed in.
She was so unbelievably brave to go up against a huge force like the police, and, you know, I think that she has that legacy that she's left behind.
And going in it, she knew what they were capable of. She knew that they killed people. She saw them kill her boyfriend. So she knew the risk she was taking. It's just sad that she wasn't given the protection she deserved.
I agree.
Okay, so some thank yous. Firstly, to our patrons on Patreon. Thank you to Megan M, Amanda T, Laura D, Corin M, Lizzie T, Sophie G, and Amanda D. Your support means everything. And just a bit of an update for Patreon shout-outs. Charlie and I are horribly behind, so please don't think we have missed giving you a shout-out. We are only now just giving shout-outs for patrons starting in April, so we are determined to catch up and hopefully you'll hear your shout-out soon. And then to the beautiful five-star reviews. Thank you to Tracy MSP, Tracy Michelle, Starling 1980, JPHIF, and That Swedish Girl. I know that iTunes does not make it easy to leave reviews, but we really appreciate it. We do read all of them and ugly cry at your support, so thank you. So where can people find you again, Jess?
So Kiwi Crimes is available anywhere you get your podcasts, and if you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Kiwi Crimes Pod, or on Facebook at Kiwi Crimes Podcast Discussion Group. Come and join us.
And we're on Facebook. We have the page where we post all the episodes and discussion group that we do exactly that. We discuss crimes, we discuss documentaries, books. We have posts of cute animals to break up the murders and the missing and all the other horrible things in this world. We are on Twitter where you can chat to Charlie, and that's at InsightfulPod. I post photos on Instagram, and that's at InsightPod. And we are on the emails, insightfulpod@gmail.com. We have a PayPal for a one-off donation and a Patreon for an ongoing monthly donation. On Patreon, we have some great rewards for our patrons, like monthly bonus episodes, stickers, magnets, t-shirts, and a thank you card from Charlie. All links are on our website, insightpod.com. You can also listen to our episodes there and read our show notes and access some additional research if you want to read up some more on the cases we cover. You can also listen to our latest episodes and buy some merch at orbitaljigsaw.com.
And finally, it would mean the world to us if you would rate, review and subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. It does really help. It gives us a bump up the charts and brings more people to the podcast.